Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm Mark Calder in Aberdeen, Scotland. Today we'll be talking to Bod Cordwright about his book, Dilemmas of Attachment, Identity and Belonging Among Palestinian Christians. It's a really interesting book. It's packed full of ethnographic detail, which makes it enjoyable to read. And the theoretical reflections add a great deal of value due to their attention to the ambiguities and political implications associated with such a diverse debate as Palestinian Christians. So, Bod Cordwright in Oslo, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot.
Bod, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a Norwegian anthropologist. I'm from an Arctic village of some 800 people in the north of Norway. But I left the Arctic to study in Bergen on the Norwegian west coast at 18, and that's where I stumbled onto anthropology in the Middle East as an area of study. So I started off with a master's degree, and later on ended up doing a PhD with a focus on Christian Palestinians. So, yeah. That's a brief introduction.
Yeah, indeed. How did you come to write Dilemmas of Attachment then? Was that based on your PhD research?
Well, yes, maybe I can I'll backtrack a little bit. It's sort of, as a master's student, I wrote a thesis on Palestinian return migration from the US to the West Bank. Mm-hmm. For that, I conducted fieldwork in some Palestinian villages in 2000, just before the Second Intifada broke out. And while there, while doing fieldwork, I got to know a few Christian Palestinians then in Ramallah, on the central part of the West Bank. And I got to learn that this was a small but resourceful group, well-educated, politically engaged, and proud of their history in the region. Mm. And I also got the sense that they were emigrating at a fairly high rate. So I wanted to learn a bit more about these people, about their history in the region and about their position in as Palestinian society.
And so was this the question that you sought to pursue through your PhD research then in terms of emigration?
Well, it's sort of that was my starting point. But it's sort of I was particularly intrigued by this tension that arises from their identity as their national identity as Palestinians, as members of an Arab and predominantly Muslim community, and as Christians, as members of a wider Christian community, where bigger Western churches have a history of strong support for Israel, which has sort of been a source of some resentment, some disappointment among local Christians. So I wanted to learn a bit more about how these tensions as well played out in the Palestinian context.
I see. Maybe it would be helpful for listeners to have a quick overview of Palestinian Christians, their numbers, where they're concentrated, perhaps how they have been represented in the past.
Yes, it's a fairly small community of around 50,000 people that now live in the West Bank, in Gaza, and in East Jerusalem. That's a bit more than 1% of the Palestinian population in the occupied territories. Mm-hmm. And they belong to 13 different church communities, which the biggest is the Greek Orthodox and the Catholic Church. And for the most part, they constitute a fairly well-educated middle-class minority. For generations, they have had privileged access to church-run private schools that are far better than public schools now and in the past. Many of them work in educational health institutions, international NGOs in the tourist sector, and as a community, they're more socially liberal than their Muslim neighbors. Mm-hmm. Now, historically, they consider themselves descendants of people who lived there before the Muslim Arab invasions of the 6th century. And their small numbers are partly due to a long history of immigration, especially from the Bethlehem area. An immigration that dates back to the late Ottoman period. But in spite of this, they still hold a considerable influence in the Palestinian community. Mm. Christian intellectuals played a central role in developing a modern secular Palestinian nationalism, and they still hold a fairly strong voice in Palestinian politics. And today, sort of local Christians, whether clerics or community activists, are sort of still very active in that when it comes to creative, nonviolent forms of resistance to the Israeli occupation. So yeah, that's a few words on that.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Could you describe your own focus in the Bethlehem area? Why did you choose to focus on Bethlehem in particular then? Was it mainly because of this history of emigration? Or is there something else about Bethlehem that's particularly interesting?
Well, Bethlehem is kind of it's a stronghold of Palestinian Christianity. So almost half of the Christians that are left, around 22,000, live in the town of Bethlehem and the neighboring towns of Beit Jala and Beit Sahur. So that was sort of that was basically my starting point. But it's also a very it's an interesting region. It's very socially diverse. There is Bethlehem itself with its rich biblical heritage, and the local population that's immensely proud of that. There's also a number of refugee camps based in that area, and several sort of smaller villages surrounding Bethlehem itself.
You actually talk, I think, earlier in your book about Bethlehem as comprising different social worlds. What do you mean by this exactly? Is it just that there's these different rural refugee camps, urban zones, if you like, or is there something a bit more, I don't know, cultural, social, about that different social worlds?
Well, it's the divides I talk about, they're part of it. It's sort of this is one of the first things I sort of noticed coming there. I came to Bethlehem in the summer of 2006 for the first time, and I started working partly as an English tutor at a student center associated with Bethlehem University. And at this student center, where there were local Palestinian students that wanted to basically learn some conversational English. Many of them most of these students were from refugee camps and from villages around Bethlehem. They came from families with plenty of children, usually fairly poor families, and basically getting to Bethlehem University at all had been quite an achievement for them. Mm. But some of them had also basically completed a 3 or 4 year degree at Bethlehem University, some in business studies, pretty much without being able to put together more than very, very basic sentences in English. Mm. And this was a first immediate contrast with the Christian communities of the Bethlehem area. I got the chance to live with a Greek Orthodox family based in Beit Sahur, and through that family and through that neighborhood, so that I got to know them. I got an immediate introduction to the local Christian communities. They were characterized by, well, higher levels of education. Most of them spoke English quite well. Many of them had attended church-run private schools in the area. Some had lived abroad, and they had in some ways, we might say, a kind of a cultural orientation towards the West culturally. Mm. Yeah, in many ways, many of them had lots of family, lots of relatives living in the U.S., in Europe, and certainly in Latin America. And when it comes to immigration, when it came to personal aspirations, young people either had sort of fairly high ambitions in terms of what they could or wanted to achieve in the West Bank, or they had a clear ambitions of getting out, right, of going to to the U.S. or Europe for studies or work. And these were sort of among the students at this student forum. Some of them also had the ideas of going out, of emigrating, but if so, it was more a matter of plans for short-term trips to Jordan or the Gulf States, if possible. But most of all, they had their main ambitions were just they basically live decent lives in the Bethlehem area. So in terms of perceptions of their own possibilities, in terms of aspirations, I experience quite a gap between these two worlds.
It's very interesting how you bring out the difference between the ways in which Palestinian Christians understand themselves to be connected to a wider world, and also Palestinian Muslims in Bethlehem, and contrasts between refugees and urban elites and so on. Just focusing on Palestinian Christians for the time being, and especially with questions of their identity, Christians in Palestine have become a kind of currency in very shrill political contests, some of which you describe early on in your book. Were you concerned at all about your work being appropriated in ways that could distort Palestinian Christian realities or even harm their interests?
Yes, certainly. In many ways, the situation of minorities in the Middle East altogether has become something of a political focus in Western countries in recent years, not just in Palestine, but in Egypt as well. Hmm. But it's been a focus on in Palestine for the last 10 years or so, at least. And there's been quite a bit of alarm about the flight of Christians from the area. And so this notion that they are almost disappearing from the area. Mm. And it's become kind of a battle over narratives of who's to blame for this, Israel or Palestinian Muslims, basically. And local Christians find themselves in the middle of this. And they have a clear interest in shaping their own narrative. Mm. And as a researcher, I find it important to convey the complexity in all this. Mm. On the one hand, this is a community with some internal tensions, certainly some conflicts some conflicts between Christians and Muslims as well. At the same time, there is the occupation, which has a stifling effect on all Palestinians, Christians as well, and in some ways it has harmed the Christian communities in particular ways.
Such as,
it's in the Bethlehem area, in particular, sort of the closing off of Bethlehem. Has had a devastating effect on the tourist industry. The tourist industry is a lifeline for many Christians in the Bethlehem area. When it comes to land confiscations, a lot of land has been confiscated by Israel for the building of settlements, for the building of the wall. Especially in and around the Bethlehem area, and much of this land has belonged to Christian landowners. And another thing is the whole Israeli restrictions on return for Palestinians that have lived abroad. The Israeli rules of regulations when it comes to the right to settle, the right to residency in Palestine changes all the time. And this is something that strongly affects those who have lived a bit abroad, those who have family members abroad, wish to come back. Mm. And in the Bethlehem area, this is the case for many Christian Palestinians in particular, I think, due to their fairly strong history of emigration.
I think one of the really compelling features of your book is how you, if you like, remain faithful to the complexity all the way through. And another aspect of that are the multiple loyalties that Palestinian Christians may have and the various kinds of group to which they may belong. Could you describe some of this for our listeners, the kinds of group loyalties that might have a decisive role in the way Palestinian Christians in Bethlehem understand themselves?
Well, it's sort of as I mentioned earlier, it's Bethlehem is a it's a very it's a diverse area with various social divisions. It's an area where people are divided along different lines. Traditionally, these local communities have been organized along by family clans, and to this day, patriarchal family clans, some that can number up to more than 10,000, can be a source of land, wealth, power, and protection. But this also means that smaller family clans, to which many Christians belong, can be a source of vulnerability. Then there are social divides between villages, long-time city dwellers, camp-based refugees, and communities of settled Bedouins in the area. Then there are regional divisions between those belonging to the Bethlehem area and people from other parts of the West Bank, in particular the district of Hebron. And there are sort of deep socioeconomic cleavages, with a large population of poorer villages and refugees, and with a significant wealth concentrated among a few elite families. And there are political the divisions between political factions as well. In the Bethlehem area itself, in different situations, different identities are sort of actualized in a sense. I had my primary base in Beit Sahur, which is known as a city with a strong sense of sort of internal solidarity, where sort of conflicts could erupt between members from someone from a Bethlehem family and someone from outside of Bethlehem, from a Beit Sahur family and someone from outside of Beit Sahur, from a nearby Muslim village, from a Hebron family, or a Christian families from Bethlehem. Mm-hmm. Sometimes conflicts involving disputes over the sale of land, which in the case of Beit Sahur there was a strong sense of duty about keeping the Beit Sahur land within the village. And this is something that actually transcended Christian Muslim lines as well. But when it comes to in relation to sort of the outside world, in relation to Israel, these internal tensions are to some extent set aside. There is a strong sense, certainly among Bethlehem Christians, that in relation to the outside world, it is important to keep a united front as Palestinians as well. There is a sense of strong. There are concerns about their position in Palestine as even a minority. Deep concerns considering the strength and future fate of Hamas, the political movement, and whether in a Palestine dominated by such movements, what kind of place there will be for them as Christians. But at the same time, they have historically, they have a lot invested in kind of a secular nationalist vision of Palestine, and sort of baked into this is this what you might call an ethos of national unity. This idea that you stand together against the outside world and you keep internal differences to oneself until national liberation has been achieved. So it's sort of in concrete contexts. In situations of strong confrontations with Israel, in particular, this sort of this internal solidarity that sort of that crosses all internal lines. This Palestinian national solidarity is very visible and very very strong.
There's lots of interesting theory that you deal with in the book. I just want to focus on one of the key concepts that you use, which is borrowed from Brubaker, which is that of deepness. Yes. And it seems to be relevant to what you're talking about there. Could you just elaborate a little bit on this idea of groupness with reference to your Palestinian Christian interlocutors?
Well, it's sort of Rubik starts out with a basic distinction between categories, as you know, aggregates of people who may share certain characteristics, and groups, that's aggregates of people who, on the basis of those characteristics, also share a collective consciousness, a sense of solidarity, and a capacity for collective action. And he goes on to distinguish between groups and groupness. By that, he refers to, well, he refers to groupness as an event, as a phenomenon, where a sense of group belonging and commonality can occur occasionally, triggered by specific events or situations between people who may not usually strongly regard themselves as a group. And, well, in Palestine, Israeli transgressions, military or politically, can at times have that effect of bringing people together as Palestinians. And while I was there in 2006, in the summer of 2006, this was a few months after Hamas had come to power. At the time there was basically a Hamas government that had been boycotted by the international community, and that boycott had an effect on. It affected everyone. It harmed everyone, and it had some absurd consequences. For instance, Bethlehem University, where most of the sort of young people in the Bethlehem area want to go, it's a Catholic university, originally established by the Vatican, and it still gets quite a bit of funding from through the Catholic Church, but it also depends on. On fairly high student tuitions. But during, at this time, due to the boycott, a lot of families were hurting financially and struggling to sort of to mobilize the money to send their kids to the university. What happened then was a lot of them received generous funding, scholarships from Saudi Arabia. So you have a situation in which, due to a boycott aimed at weakening Hamas, a Catholic university and its Christian students find themselves relying on Saudi funding.
Interesting.
And so it's sort of this boycott against Hamas sort of did rally people together, even those who passionately hated Hamas in some sense. During the summer of 2006, Israel also arrested a number of Hamas parliamentarians, and this too was seen as a grave insult against Palestinians and against a Palestinian democratic institution. And then there was the Lebanon War as well. This was the year when Hamas kidnapped some Israeli soldiers on the border. Hezbollah kidnapped a few. Some Israeli soldiers on the border between Israel and Lebanon. And Israel started a fairly heavy military incursion into the south of Lebanon with devastating consequences for some of those communities in Lebanon. At the same time, there was a fairly strong Israeli military offensive against Gaza. And during this time, local Palestinians, Christian and Muslim, were in a rage. They organized big demonstrations and truly passionate in their opposition to Israel in every way, and also in their support for Hezbollah. I would talk to local priests who would praise the leader of Hezbollah for his brave opposition to Israel. And it's sort of this is the kind of situation that invoked not just a Palestinian, but a strong sense of Arab identity.
If that's the performance of Palestinian groupness as a response to the threat of Israeli overreach or restrictions or violence. Could you give us an example of a different kind of groupness, or perhaps the same people performing groupness as they relate to a different kind of group?
Well, it's sort of the next year you had some other well, actually, the same year, we had some other situations that triggered basically religious tensions in the area. You had the aftermath of the Muhammad cartoon crisis. This was an incident in which a Danish newspaper published some cartoons, fairly controversial cartoons of Muhammad, which started a massive campaign of protests against Denmark and later Norway for publishing these cartoons. In Palestine, we talked to local Christians who said that during these few months, when there were huge rallies against these cartoons, they actually found that relations between Christians and Muslims were a bit strained because of this. In some sense, local Christians sometimes experience being seen as basically the extension of Western Christianity. And this was seen a bit later as well in the fall of 2006 when Pope Benedict made some rather offensive comments about the prophet as well. When that happened, four churches in Palestine were arsoned, and there were rumors that someone had attempted to arson the Catholic Church in Beit Zahur as well. Mm. But I was there at the time, and I couldn't see any signs of that. Mm. But sort of at that time as well, it sort of this created a sense among many Christians that a sense of vulnerability, a sense of being sort of standing out, as being seen in some situation as internal others. Mm. So there's those kind of situations as well that can occur.
That's really interesting. And gender plays a very important role in your analysis as well. How would you summarize the centrality of gender in your account beyond the quite familiar stereotypes of Middle Eastern gender roles?
Well, it's the Christian communities of Palestine tend to be they take pride in seeing themselves as a bit more socially liberal in many ways than their Muslim neighbors. Mm-hmm. When it comes to when it comes to gender roles and when it comes to sort of the focus on individual freedom and all these things. But at the same time, a patriarchal family structure is certainly still holds a strong place within these communities. Mm. And this is particularly evident when it comes to marriage arrangements. Deciding who to... first of all, when it comes to... it's sort of the rules of social interaction between men and women, between young boys and girls, still fairly strict and relative to most European society. Any social interaction between young boys and girls is fairly tightly monitored. Mm-hmm. And young women do have to look out for their own social reputation. Having any kind of serious romantic involvement before getting married is usually frowned upon. And who you get to marry, who you can marry, is not a it's not entirely up to the individual, and it's certainly there are some clear terms for who one might be allowed to marry, mm-hmm. who's considered a suitable partner. Historically, everyone was expected to find a partner within their own church community. Now, many of the church communities, especially in the Bethlehem area, are fairly small, so that's no longer almost possible. Mm-hmm. In the last three or four decades, it's become much more common to find a partner. If you belong to the Orthodox Church, to find a Catholic partner, for instance. Mm-hmm. But when you marry, has to come from a family of good standing. Mm. And especially for young women. It is vital to have your family's blessing in terms of when choosing who to marry. Looking at individual cases, I did find some cases of young men who were able to kind of force through their will and being allowed to marry someone that their family at first did not approve of.
Mm-hmm.
This is far more difficult for young women.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it's the ideals of romantic love and ideals of individual freedom in this area are growing stronger. And in recent years, there has been a few cases of marriage by elopement. Young people who have run away and gotten married to someone that their families did not approve of. And this is something I write about as well. It's I describe a few cases of some cases of young people running away and marrying someone that their families do not approve of. And it's some moral alarm within the community. There's a sense of among the older generation, there has been a among some people, there is a sense of all rules being basically being dissolved. And when someone runs away and marries someone that that the families don't approve of, and they are forgiven for it afterwards, that in particular is seen as very alarming, setting an unfortunate precedent.
Mm.
And in a community where there is so much uncertainty, where politically they've been living in limbo for decades, there's nothing resembling a kind of a political solution to the conflicts in the horizon. Economically, people are struggling in general. Some families are leaving the country, or some members are leaving the country. Basically, people experience this uncertainty and instability, so many disruptions in so many areas that a patriarchal family structure is seen by many as an important anchor, one thing that they could cling to as kind of a source of certainty. Yeah, and when that as well is being being challenged, this is tough on a lot of people.
Mm. Yeah, you describe at one point how upheaval, this very radical and very rapid change in Bethlehem, has heightened tensions between those conservative forces and these kind of forces of change, if you like, referring in particular to gender roles and marriage. Do you think it has a broader application, this tension between conservative forces and forces of change being exacerbated in the context of upheaval? I'm thinking in particular of like everyday applications of Christianity, on the one hand very traditional and maybe pietistic, on the other hand very radical and politically engaged, both of which feature quite prominently in contemporary Palestinian Christian discourse.
Well, yeah, it's kind of in the Palestinian context, you kind of find a drive towards both in among local Christians, not just local Christians, but certainly among local Christians, there are some people, some families, young people as well, who are turning to religion, who are turning to Christianity as a source of identity and as a source of as a kind of anchor, I guess. Kind of in response to all these uncertainties, and also in response to what some of them perceive as a sort of growing pressure from a sort of a local Muslim majority population. You have some segments of a local Christian community that sort of turn inwards towards religion, towards the church, and towards sort of their own display of their own religious identity. And then there are also especially among young people, there are those who are fiercely wish to protect kind of a sense of to some extent a secular liberal lifestyle, that they want to they want to expand against the will of older generations within their own community, and they want to protect against what they see as conservative forces in society in general. So there are several cross-cutting drives in this context, and it's sort of in a context of political uncertainty and economic depression as well, which has been a feature in Palestine for some time. It's a sense of social freedom is considered quite essential among many people.
Changing focus a little bit, you give a very powerful account of the effects of the occupation upon the physical environment of Bethlehem.
Yes.
I'm quite interested in the relationship between these physical, concrete changes in the Bethlehem environment and then symbolic changes in the ways in which Palestinians think about themselves, represent themselves, ascribe meaning to the world. Could you talk a little bit about the way in which physical disconnection has affected Palestinians and Christians in particular when it comes to, for want of a better phrase, their symbolic lives, their dwelling in the Holy Land, their relationship to modernity, to the Christian world, and so on?
All right. Well, it's I've been based in the Bethlehem area, and Christians in Palestine, they take in Bethlehem in particular, they take immense pride in Bethlehem and Bethlehem's centrality to Christianity itself. Mm. They also have a strong emotional connection with Jerusalem, and it's sort of there's this dramatic context which contrasts between the fact that there are people living in Bethlehem who have, members of the families have emigrated to other parts of the world. They have family connections throughout the Middle East, Latin America, in the US, in Europe. Mm-hmm. Some of these they have daily contact with now through the internet. And some of them have also lived abroad and hold one or two foreign passports themselves. Hmm. But on the West Bank, as Palestinians, they are stuck in Bethlehem. Sort of just getting to Ramallah, half an hour's drive away, can be a major hassle. Hmm. And Jerusalem, which is located just 5 miles to the north, is mostly blocked for them. Hmm. And some of these Bethlehem Christians haven't been able to visit Jerusalem in a decade. And in terms of their attachment to the area, to local places, in terms of their sort of the local anchoring of their Christian identity, this is quite dramatic. It's sort of Jerusalem is they live in and around Bethlehem. Jerusalem is still kind of a what they see as their main spiritual center, in a sense.
Mm.
And not being able to for those who still feel really strongly about their some religious identity in particular, not being able to visit Jerusalem at all, not being able to visit the holy sites, the holy churches of Jerusalem, is quite a dramatic loss in many ways, and it contrasts so sharply with the extent to which they are connected with the rest of the world in other ways, with their sense of relational mobility in some sense. Sort of this sense of relational mobility it contrasts dramatically with their complete lack of physical mobility in the Bethlehem area.
That's really interesting. I think one of the things that really struck me, not least in reading your book, was the way in which, as well as this disconnection, if you like, physically, symbolically, to places elsewhere, particularly Jerusalem and to Israel and so on, places which matter greatly to them. There's also a kind of disconnection from Bethlehem as well because of internal migration, which you deal with an awful lot. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
A disconnection from...
A kind of sense of having... I use it almost metaphorically, really, a sense of having been displaced within their own town because they no longer recognize that their own town, if you like.
Yeah. You know, this is particularly... this is something that's an experience that's particularly strong among those who live in Bethlehem itself.
Right.
So, there's a difference here between Bethlehem, Beit Sahur, and Beit Jala. And in Bethlehem, in particular, this experience is quite strong. It's about for the last few hundred years, Bethlehem has been a Christian majority town. It had historically, it's sort of the city. The city has consisted of seven family clans, six of which were Christian, one which was Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
And basically around the turn of the century, around late 1800s, when Christian families started emigrating to Latin America in particular, this was the case. Christians were clearly in majority, and they owned much of the land around Bethlehem at the time. But then, as families started emigrating, they sold their land, and much of this land was sold to Muslim families in the area, and especially from the Hebron area. And this is a development that's been going on throughout the 19th century as well. No, sorry, the 20th century as well.
Mm-hmm.
With wealthy families from other parts of the West Bank, Muslim families are buying land, buying properties in around Bethlehem. This is something that's being referred to as the Hebronization of the Bethlehem area. In addition, three refugee camps have been after 1948, after the expulsion of Palestinians from today's Israel. Three refugee camps were established around Bethlehem that are now held to, I do not know how many, but almost many thousand, tens of thousands of refugees.
Mm.
And they too sort of constitute a strong presence in the city itself and around.
What does this presence look like? I suppose that's what I'm driving at. What is the everyday experience of this in migration?
Well, it's sort of the experience, the local, those who consider themselves old Bethlehemites, is that they have gone from constituting 90% of the city's population to maybe 25. And they experience that, especially as many properties in the old city of Bethlehem has been taken over by Hebron families. They experience that this has changed the social character of the city to some extent as well. Mm. Hebron, the Hebronites are sort of considered more, have been considered fairly sort of socially conservative in many ways, to the extent that families, because who consider themselves sort of old Muslim Bethlehemites, they have complained that sort of these newcomers from Hebron have sort of changed the terms of what it means to be Muslims in Bethlehem itself. So this is kind of the main thing. They experience that they as Christians no longer dominate Bethlehem, and that the city is sort of, the town is slowly changing in front of them. Whereas they have their biggest family networks mainly in Chile and other places in Latin America. Their local social base is shrinking. Now this experience is fairly strong in Bethlehem and to some extent in Beit Jala. This is much less the case in Beit Sahur, which is where the Christians still constitute 75% of the population, and they've been very insistent on not selling their land to outsiders.
That's really interesting. That summary. Just one general question, really. It's a little bit off-piste, if you like. Christians in the Middle East are in the media an awful lot at the moment, and not much of it is good news, really. Do you have any optimism at all for Christians in Palestine, in the region more generally, even other minority groups? What's the future, if you like, of that ancient pluralism of the Levant, as far as you see it?
Well, actually, I'm kind of in terms of immigration, I do think that if the political situation keeps deteriorating and there's nothing leading towards a kind of a political solution anytime soon, at least in Palestine, this is certainly going to sort of lead to more immigration and Christians being local Christians being sort of fairly well connected, well resourceful, well educated, they are will be among the first to leave. Mm. This is all the way it always is in any sort of conflict setting. But at the same time, the few that stay behind are the local Christians have historically they have the legacy of their own contribution to establishing a secular Palestinian national identity. And I kind of think this to some extent gives them a local buffer as well. It strengthens their sense of belonging, their local investment in the area, and also their commitment among local Muslims to work towards keeping the local Christian presence alive. When it comes to the rest of the region, in general, I'm quite pessimistic. We know that in Iran, the Christian communities of Iran has been completely decimated following the aftermath of the civil wars following the American invasion in 2003. in Syria. Well, who knows what's going to happen in Syria? But it's sort of the Assad regime is unimaginably brutal. It's sort of local Christians seem to they experience a much worse fate under ISIS rule, where they still hold the power. So whatever happens there is, well, it's hard to say. In Egypt, they have a 8 million people strong community. I think the situation for Copts in Egypt it's hard to say what happens there, but what happens in Egypt at this point is most of all dominated by the strengthening of a repressive military system that's much more repressive than any system they've had before. And that's sort of that's a problem for anyone living in the area. Well, so all in all, I'm not optimistic.
Well, thank you anyway for giving us your perspective on that, and also for taking us through some aspects of your book. We've taken up a lot of your time. It's been really great to hear about your book, Dilemmas of Attachment. I wonder if you could end up by just telling us what you're working on at the present, since you finished that book.
Well, currently I'm working on a project focusing on masculinity among Egyptian Copts.
Right.
And for that, I've been conducting fieldwork in Alexandria. And being based in Alexandria, northern Egypt, I've also as a side project, I've focused a little bit on the remaining small Christian communities of Alexandria as well. Mm-hmm. Sort of the small, tiny remains of what was once cosmopolitan Alexandria. So I'm sort of I'm kind of still sticking with the Christian minority situation.
Mm. Well, we look forward to reading that one. Maybe we'll get a chance to talk about that as well in due course. I'd urge all of our listeners to get hold of Dilemmas of Attachment. It's really quite an important contribution to this conversation about minority. The sustainability of minorities in the Middle East. And it's been really great talking to you, Bod. That's all we've got time for just now. So let me close by thanking you for a really stimulating conversation and wish you every success with your current work.
Thank you so much.